I want to thank Jason and the worship team for our time of worship this morning, especially for the last song, which is a perfect introduction to a new series that we're launching this morning, How Great is Our God. When I applied to be the pastor here at CBC some 25 years ago, I had to list what practically everybody has to list on a job application, and that is I had to give a set of references, names of people that knew me well, who could vouch for my character, who had observed my work and my ministry, and so those were listed on a reference page that the search committee here got to make contact with. So I had four or five people listed on that page as references, and Gary Miller and the search committee did make contact and had conversations with each of those people. Well, they came to one guy, a friend at our church in North Carolina, who had a wonderful wife and kids, and had kids about our age. They're highly involved in the church. Great guy and a great family. And they were good friends. We hung out. We spent a lot of time together, enjoyed each other's company. We're in a small group together. We served together, prayed together. Just a wonderful family at that church in North Carolina. Well, the CBC search committee was talking with my friend, and he affirmed lots of nice things about me, and the search committee found those observations helpful. But somewhere in that conversation, my friend was asked this question. Would you like Steve to be your pastor? And he said no. Now, it's got to be really odd to have on your resume, in your references, a guy that you know is going to answer no to that question. But I did know that. I knew my friend well, and I knew what he meant. But it was a shock to the committee. He knew me well. He liked me. He respected me. Thought I'd make a fine senior pastor. Just not for him. And the reason for that is the church that I came from in Durham was Southern Baptist, and my friend was staunchly Southern Baptist. And he knew that I really felt more at home in a Bible church. And so while he thought I would make a fine pastor in a Bible church, he was not at all wanting me to be his pastor because I wasn't fully in on being Southern Baptist. But other than that minor detail, he was a great reference for me. But quite a surprise to hear, would you like Steve to be your pastor when he's applying for a pastoral position? And you get, no. So I'm occasionally asked to give references for people, and I always enjoy doing that. Sometimes it's just a simple email that an organization or a group or an employer wants. Sometimes there's a form they want me to fill out that has checkoff boxes or places to fill in the blank, and sometimes they want me to compose something a bit more involved. Whatever that involves, I always enjoy doing that. It's a pleasure and honor for me. But when employers or organizations or ministries come looking for a reference like that, they're looking for two things to show up there. They want to know what the person is like and what has the person done. The first one deals with the person's character and nature. You've been around this person, you've observed them. What are they like? Just tell us what they're like. Some personality traits. And the second one deals with the person's accomplishments or ways that they've served or things that they've led in or they've contributed to. And we all have both aspects of that, who we are and what we've done. Nature and character on the one side versus actions and accomplishments on the other, or being on one side, who we are as beings, and then doing, the being versus the doing. And those are important to the full picture of who we are. And the same is true for God. There's a being aspect to God, and there's a doing aspect to God. Well, about 3 or 4 years ago, I did a series on the names of God. It doesn't seem quite that long, but I looked back and it has been. But that series really, for the most part, focused on what God does. And the reason it did, because the names of God actually, not all of them, but most of them, hone in on some thing that God does, some action that God takes. For instance, Jehovah Jireh means the Lord who provides. And so it's talking to us about, it's describing God as a provider. He provides for his people. Jehovah Rapha, the Lord who heals. He heals us. Jehovah Rohi, the Lord who shepherds. He's our great shepherd, our good shepherd. We were sheep, and so that's an action that God takes in caring for us. He shepherds us well. Jehovah Mekadesh, the Lord who sanctifies. Emmanuel means God with us, or God came to be with us. It's an action that God did where he came near through the incarnation. He came to be with us. Adonai means Lord and Master. That's a title, but certainly it also reflects action. He acts from the position of being Lord and Master. And then also, Elohim means mighty creator. It describes actions that God does. He is the almighty creator. He made it all. And so those types of names, for the most part, describe actions, things that God does. Well, today, for the next few weeks, we're going to launch into a series that takes a closer look at who God is. And for that, we're going to look into God's attributes, his nature and character. And I've always loved studying the attributes of God. It's been something that's just been on my heartbeat for a long, long time. And there are some great books out there which are fantastic resources and would be great additions to any person's library. But two in particular stand out. One is by J.I. Packer called Knowing God. Came out in the late 1970s. It's a classic and outstanding book on knowing God, hence the title. And then before that, about 10 or 20 years before that, was A.W. Tozer's book, Knowledge of the Holy. Again, a fantastic book on getting to know God. Both of those are outstanding, well worth having, and I recommend them to you. So there's probably 20 or 21, 22 of these different attributes we want to cover. We'll cover three or four a week for the next 7 or 8 weeks. Except this morning, we'll get to three of them a little later on, but I need to kind of lay some foundational groundwork to this, and so that's where we're headed first. If we are going to study the very nature and character of God, it's worth knowing that this is considered the most important thing that a child of God could ever undertake. The study of God, who he is, and how to know him better. And it's a topic that you can never exhaust. You'll never run out of stuff. There's always more to know about God. King David wrote in Psalm 139, verse 6, when thinking about or dwelling on the idea of knowing God more, he wrote this: such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It's too wonderful. It's beyond him. It's above him. And yet God invites us to know him nonetheless. He invites us to know him deeply, to learn all that we can about him, from his word, from the special revelation of Christ when he came 2,000 years ago and walked among us, to the very general revelation that he gives in creation. He wants us to walk with him intimately, to know him personally, to experience him on a one-on-one level of knowing him, knowing God. The great English preacher Charles Spurgeon once told his church, "I believe that the proper study of God's people is God himself. The highest science, the loftiest speculation, the mightiest philosophy which can ever engage the attention of a child of God is the name, the nature, the person, the work, the doings, and the existence of the great God whom we humbly call Father." Knowing God is the greatest pursuit of a human being in this earthly life. And yet, as we dig into knowing God more and knowing more about his attributes, there are three things that limit that study, that pursuit. The first is we have a human mind that is finite. We serve a God and want to know a God who is infinite. And so we're trying to grab all we can about this infinite God and stuff that into a pea-sized brain like Steve's. And so there's limitations built into we're finite. Second, our fallenness and our sin hinders our capacity to understand spiritual truth, and in particular spiritual truth about God. So because we live in a fallen world and we're fallen beings with a corrupt mind and a corrupt soul, that limits our ability to understand rightly the spiritual truth set before us. And third, as much as God has delighted to reveal some of himself to us in his word and through the person of Christ when he walked on earth and in his created order around us, the fact is he has not revealed all to us. There is so much more about God that we won't get to know until we see him in heaven, when the shackles of our fallenness is removed and when the expansiveness of our minds becomes much greater than what the limits are in our human capacity now and as human beings. To know what that's going to be in glory is going to be amazing. So there's much, much more we will get to know about God when we see him in glory. But until then, there are some built-in limitations. And yet, God says, even with this limited knowledge, limited capacity to some extent, we are to pursue with our whole heart getting to know him and to know him well. Jeremiah 9, verses 23 and 24 that we'll read for us. Again, it says this: "Thus says the Lord." I'm sorry, he read something else. Did he read this? He did. I knew that. It says, "Thus says the Lord, let not a wise man boast in his wisdom. Let not the mighty man boast of his might. Let not a rich man boast of his riches. But let him who boasts, boast of this, that he understands and knows me." And you can see the importance and the centrality of knowing God, even in the Apostle Paul's prayers. Practically every time he prays for one of the churches that he was ministering to or had established, he refers to knowing God more. For instance, in Colossians chapter 1, Paul's prayer to the believers in Colossae, he says this: For this reason also, since the day we heard of it, the day they'd heard of their great faith, which is referred to earlier, for this reason also, since the day we heard of it, we have not ceased to pray for you and to ask that you may be filled with the knowledge of his will in all spiritual wisdom and understanding, so that you may walk in a manner worthy of the Lord, to please him in all respects, bearing fruit in every good work and increasing in the knowledge of God. And increasing in the knowledge of God. That was his prayer for the Colossian believers. That was his prayer for practically every church that he ministered to. He was always referring back to knowing God more intimately, walking in his ways. So the knowledge of God should affect who we are, how we see ourselves, and how we live in this world, in this earthly life. Now, as we study these attributes, there is a danger of this just being head knowledge. There's the danger of this being simply an exercise of learning more about God, not really knowing God more deeply. And that's not the idea. That's not the goal. In fact, that would be a tragic loss if we simply came to know more about God. We want to know him more. I can tell you, I can rattle off all kinds of facts and details about my wife. And we can spend a lot of time telling all this stuff about her. By the time I'm done, you will not know Jan any more intimately than you do now. You will know more things about her. But to know her more closely, to know her more intimately, involves a relationship. It involves a personal connection. It involves spending time with that person. And that's what God calls us to. He calls us to a close relationship with himself. We don't want to just know about him. We want to know him, to draw close to him, to fellowship with him, to commune with him, to abide with him. If I were to hold up a pen or these glasses and describe details about this, it has, you know, two lenses and circled with metal and little plastic nose guards, and it's got two little ear things, and there's a little plastic guard on the end of that, and it's kind of reddish brown. And I can tell you all kinds of facts, but that's not a personal connection to these glasses. It's facts about something. And we don't want to spend our time the next few weeks just learning facts about God. They're important facts to know. We want to draw close and know him more. So these attributes can help us and should help us understand and appreciate this great God that we desperately want to know and love with our whole heart. So it's a very good thing to study his word and learn what God says about himself. These are attributes that God uses to describe himself to us, and that's very important to know. Now, there are a handful of these attributes that are very important as foundational attributes of God, and we're going to tackle them first, three of them today and a couple more next time. Most of these are what we call incommunicable attributes as opposed to communicable attributes. What does that mean? So think about a communicable disease. It's the best way to think about this. What is a communicable disease? Well, it's a disease that you can catch from somebody else. It's a disease that is communicated or transferred from one person to the next, like Ebola. If you're around somebody that's got Ebola, you're going to get Ebola. AIDS, transfer from person to person. The flu, measles. Long list of those. Those diseases can be passed from person to person by human contact. But an incommunicable disease is a disease or illness that you can't spread. You can't catch diabetes from someone, or high blood pressure, or Alzheimer's, or heart disease. You never need to fear that if you're sitting in the doctor's office next to a person with high blood pressure that you're going to catch that from that person. It's not a communicable disease. You obviously cannot catch those kinds of things from that person. So communicable attributes are qualities about God that he wants to spread, that he wants to share with us, to be more loving, more just, more gracious, more good. Those are qualities he wants to communicate or transfer to us that we might grow in. Incommunicable attributes are qualities that God keeps to himself. He's all-powerful. We never will be. He's all-knowing. We never will be. He's omnipresent. We never will be. You track with me there? So they're very different. And so I want us to look at some of the incommunicable attributes of God first, stuff that you and I will never, ever become. And they're very foundational to the nature of God. First of all, God is self-existent. We looked at this quality or attribute when we studied the names of God. The name Jehovah or Yahweh, which is the most common name for God in all the Old Testament, means self-existent one. I am that I am. The great I am. That's what that name means. So this means that God has no cause. Nothing made God. He's always existed. He's before all things. Back before the universe was created, back before everything that is in the universe and the angels, all that, before anything there was just God. God alone, that was it. He was it. And that quality will never be true of us. We are not self-existent. We were made. Biologically, a man and a woman came together in sexual union, and a fertilized egg was made that became a baby. And even now, we need air to breathe, food and water to survive, rest and sleep, and so on. Biologically, those needs get met or we die. Thinking more broadly, or stepping back a bit, big picture, spiritually and historically, God made us as part of his creation, along going all the way back to Adam and Eve in the garden. God made us. We are not self-existent. So this is a quality really worth knowing and understanding about God. This obviously puts God in a whole new category of being. There's no one like him. He alone is self-existent. He alone has no other cause. He needs no one and nothing. He's dependent on nothing. He simply exists just because he's God, the self-existent one. As he told Moses, I am that I am. And nobody else can say that. Only God. He is distinct from everything else in creation, from everything else that exists, because he alone had no cause. He is the great I am. Related to that, related to his self-existence, is his self-sufficiency. This means that God is totally complete in and of himself. Nothing can be taken away from him. Nothing can be added to him. And again, there's nothing else like that in all the universe. So all that makes God God is already present within him. And since this attribute is true of God alone, it means that all things that exist proceed from God. And so we read in Colossians 1, verses 16 and 17, it says, for by him all things were created, both in the heavens and on earth, visible and invisible. Whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. Well, obviously this is so different than you and me. I mean, not only did it take a mom and a dad to sexually unite to make a fertilized egg who became who you are today, but each of us is also the product of all kinds of things. Our parents' influence, our surrounding environment, our childhood friends, our teachers and classmates, our experiences, our successes and failures, all of that shaped who you are today. Well, God has no such influences that shaped him. He already was, and he was already sufficient in and of himself. And if you're wondering how this relates to you and me, think about just the last part of that last verse about what it said about an all-sufficient God, that he holds all things together. I can hold practically nothing together. Whatever I touch, it rapidly starts to fall apart. I spent weeks in the beginning part of this summer into just about a month ago building a little walkway out of fieldstone in the front of our house under our big bald cypress tree. We can only grow dirt, and then when it rains, we grow mud. So that's what we have, and it's been that way for a long time, and we got tired of it, so I came up with an idea to build a fieldstone or flagstone walkway. So I've been digging down a trench like 4 inches deep and digging through some roots and getting those out of the way and putting down some crushed granite and then the fieldstone and shaping those and turning those around this way or that to make it work, and it came out nice. We put a couple of chairs out there with a little table to sit our iced tea on and stuff. And we've sat out there multiple times in an evening or early morning just enjoying watching traffic or saying hi to people walking their dogs or whatever. You know, we've really enjoyed that spot. Well, I've noticed, and it's only been completed about maybe 2 months, but I've noticed that there's one or two of those little field stones just beginning to dip down a little bit, and one or two others where the edges start to pop up a little bit. So I have to adjust those just a little, because probably shows this. I'm a perfectionist and that kind of thing. It really shouldn't bother me. But what it means is things tend to want to fall apart. Things are already starting to decay, if you will, or not hold together the way that I intended. And so that's how life is. I mean, we work hard at something, but we live in a fallen world and we're fallen beings, and things head toward decay, toward wearing out, toward running down, toward getting old. Not God. He does not do that. He holds all things together, and he is self-sufficient to do so. He needs no one. Well, this touches on a third incommunicable attribute of God, which is transcendence. This simply means that God is beyond his creation. He made us, but he's separate and distinct from us. He's utterly different, totally other, unique, set apart. The prophet Isaiah asks, to whom then will you liken God? Or what likeness will you compare with him? And there's nothing. It's a rhetorical question where there's just no answer. I mean, there's nothing on earth, nothing in human experience or human knowledge that can compare to God, that we can compare God to. Nothing at all. He's beyond us, totally other than us. Jeremiah 10, verse 6 declares, "There is none like you, O Lord. You are great, and great is your name." There's none like you. Even God's thoughts are distinct from ours. Isaiah 55, verses 8 and 9, the prophet writes, "For my thoughts..." God writes, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts." I am very glad to know that God does not think thoughts like my thoughts. What a convoluted mess my brain is. I'm fickle, I change my mind, I have doubts, I forget, I distort, I misunderstand, I can be illogical, I can deny clear and clear as day facts in front of my face, I can follow the latest sentiment and follow the crowd right over the cliff. I am very glad that God does not think thoughts like mine. And obviously it's a relief to know that God's ways are not our ways. In the blink of an eye, what a disaster we can make of things. We quickly hurt people, we're selfish, oblivious to our own weaknesses and issues. We have bad habits. We act out of fear sometimes, out of anger, bitterness, jealousy. But not God. His ways are not our ways. He is other. He's different. His ways are higher than ours. And for that, we can be very glad. Aren't you glad that God does not act like you? I'm very glad that God does not act like me. He's different, other, above. His thoughts are not our thoughts. His ways are not our ways. For me, the transcendence of God is a very inspiring truth, because it means that God did not just rise up out of this mess we call earth, and our God is not tainted by the fallenness of humans or the fallenness of creation itself. There actually is someone who is, was, and always will be perfect, holy, loving, good. These things were true of God before creation. They are true of God beyond creation. No matter what happens in this broken and tormented world, God is beyond it all in utter perfection. And God will always be God. And that's a glorious thing. So there is a God, and then there's everything else. And this one God made it all and stands apart from it all. He is above and beyond it all. He transcends it all. One of the things that means for you and me, whether we acknowledge it or not, is that you and I live under and below and dependent upon this great and transcendent God. And there's no escaping that fact. No one is above, no one is even equal. All are below the transcendent God. It also means that you and I cannot know ourselves apart from God. You will never fully know who you are, where you came from, why you were here, or where you're going apart from God. You will never make true sense of time and space and reality apart from God. In Him you live. In Him you move. In Him you have your being. God appointed when you were born, and He has appointed when you will die. You can reject Him, and He will still be God. You can refuse to acknowledge Him, but He will still be God. You can refuse to believe in Him, but He will still be God. He is not dependent on you or me or our beliefs in any way. He is, was, and always will be God. God is always God, transcendent above all. And then the most amazing thing, instead of staying distant from us, we could have easily have chosen to do, he actually draws near. And he says that we can find shelter under his wings. This great, glorious, self-sufficient, transcendent God says, "I will draw close and cover you with the shadow of my wings." That is a wonderfully comforting thing. What that means is that nothing can touch that comforting protection of the shadow of the Almighty. There is safety there that no human or earthly power could ever offer, and that no human or earthly power can ever penetrate or defeat. When the transcendent God offers protection and safety, nothing, nothing can come against that. God is self-existent. God is self-sufficient. God is transcendent. So there's been a bit of a lofty, heady stuff kind of beginning to the nature of God. Important stuff, but maybe not so practical in a lot of ways. Well, let's end by focusing on the middle one for just a moment as we go, the sufficiency of God. the sufficiency of God. If God is all sufficient, if God is totally complete in and of himself, and we are not, then maybe that should give us pause and cause us to think about how very insufficient you and I are, and how much we need and depend upon the one who is all sufficient. So I want you to think about a trial or a struggle you're going through right now, some challenge, some difficulty, some issue you're facing in your life right now. Think about something very specific. Take a moment. What is it you're going through? Don't say out loud, but just think of something very practical, very clear that you're wrestling with in your life right now. Some struggle, something that's got you confused or emotionally torn up, whatever. Got something in mind? With that issue, concern, problem, struggle before you're right in front of your mind there for a second and you're thinking, now think of one way that God is sufficient to meet that need. Think of one way that God is sufficient to meet that need. In whatever your issue or situation is, how is God sufficient to help, sufficient to provide, sufficient to intervene, sufficient to guide, sufficient to empower and equip you, sufficient to comfort you and give you peace? How is the sufficiency of God sufficient for you and your problem? Can you give God praise for that? Can you turn that issue or that situation over to God and rest in his sufficiency? Or do you still want to bear that problem or that trial alone in your own strength?